The training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide, LMAPL Site Management, LCSM Evolution, Decision Process, and Remedial Technologies. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2018, and although we will be able to share a lot of information with you today, we certainly will not be able to share all the tools and resources available in this guidance document. So I strongly encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you are working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. We are also recording this event to make it available on demand for those who are not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's training session. If you'd like to control your own slides, you're able to download the slides from the initial training page you were directed to today. You can also access the slides by going to the related link section, clicking on the CLUIN training page, and then clicking Browse To. We want to hear from everybody today, both your questions and your feedback. You'll have an opportunity about halfway through for questions, as well as at the end. But at any time today, you can feel free to ask your questions in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. We will try to answer as many of those questions as we can verbally during the questions and answers break, but if we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to the person in writing through our Adobe Connect website. For those of you who are on the phone line, if you would like to ask a question out loud, we will also give you an opportunity to ask your questions during the Q&A break. And we will remind you at that time that it is #6 to unmute. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you will be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will be able to certify that you participated today. Once you do that, a certificate will be issued to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one that you're participating on today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website or feel free to contact me directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the materials or endorse any specific products. On slide 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. All of them have been active members of the ITRC's LMAPL team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. Our trainers today are Tom Fox from the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety, Eric Nichols from Substrata, Matthew Rousseau from GHD, and John Smith from AECOM. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios and the links at the bottom of the page. You can also access it in the related link section by clicking the CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse To. At the bottom of the training page, you can access their bios as well. So with that said, let's move on to the next slide, and I will pass it on to Tom.
Thanks, Ted Beer. I want to welcome everybody to Part 2 of the ITRC LMAPL Training Series. Last week we covered Part 1, and we're going to be quickly moving into our Part 2 content here in a few minutes. We just want to remind you to visit the ITRC website for the updated and web-based document if you don't already have it open or downloaded. This document can be used for any LMAPL site regardless of its size or the use of the site. And here's what's new about the LMAPL guidance. We have an expanded discussion of the 9 key concepts of LMAPL behavior. We have integrated the LCSM development into the LMAPL management process. And LCSM is defined there. I don't mean to lapse into jargon with everybody. We're also going to be emphasizing SMART objectives, and I'll define that in the next slide. And we're also expanded discussion on LNAPL transmissivity and natural source zone depletion in appendices in the document. Here are our learning objectives for the three-part series that we're currently in the middle of. In part one, last week, we covered going over the LNAPL science, and I'll be talking about that in a little bit. Part two that we'll be covering today, we're going to be developing a comprehensive LCSM to identify specific LNAPL concerns at sites. And from that, we'll be establishing appropriate LNAPL remedial goals and specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound, or SMART objectives for these concerns. We'll also be informing stakeholders of the capability and also the limitations of various LNAPL remedial technologies. In part three next week, we're going to be working on selecting remedial technologies to achieve objectives, preparing for transitions between LNAPL strategies or technologies as a site moves through investigation cleanup and beyond. And also, we're going to be learning to smartly measure progress toward an identified technology-specific endpoint. The main takeaway from part one of our three-part series is that our knowledge and understanding of LNAPL behavior has evolved. We should all use that knowledge to improve our decision-making at release sites. Five key points that were made last week are that, one, LNAPL does not sit like a pancake on the water table. Two, LNAPL in a well does not mean that the LNAPL is migrating or even recoverable. Three, LNAPL transmissivity is a better indicator of recoverability than the amount of LNAPL in a well. Four, LNAPL may be present in the subsurface even if it's not in monitoring wells, and it can cause long-term compositional concerns. And fifth, biological processes play a large role in LNAPL depletion, and these have not been appreciated very much until recently. It's really important to use LNAPL science and apply it at your site to make good decisions. Our three-part training series focuses on helping you connect science to LNAPL site management, build your LNAPL conceptual site model, and select and implement LNAPL remedies. This training really isn't going to be complete unless you apply this information at your site. And after this training, we expect that you'll use it to improve your decision-making capabilities. And for you regulators out there, look at ways you can incorporate ITRC guidance into your own guidance. Today, we're going to be focusing on building the LCSM, and we'll be asking the question, do you know where the LNAPL is and how to address your LNAPL concerns? In relation to the process flow diagram that's in the LNAPL document, this is the section we'll be covering today. Today we're going to be showing you how to develop a living LCSM and how that enables you to make better LNAPL remediation and management decisions. We're also going to be discussing key LNAPL and site data for the model, when and why those data may be important, and how to effectively organize the data into the conceptual site model. We're also going to be discussing how to develop a site strategy by using the LCSM to identify and classify concerns, establish remedial goals to address those concerns, and also develop SMART remediation objectives. We asked you a question at the start of our presentation, and the question was, the projects I work on are limited by, and you get to choose the best answer. And we had the poll open, and here are the results of that poll. And it appears that most people are looking at budget constraints on their projects. A second group of people are mainly looking at technical constraints on their projects. And this isn't unusual. And actually, if you look at some of the technical constraints, they probably cause you to have budget concerns because you're having to deal with a very difficult geology or short time constraints that cause your budget to get out of control. I'd like to introduce Matt Rousseau now with GHD, and he'll begin working with us to develop the LNAPL conceptual site model. John?
Thanks, Tom. As Tom mentioned, the LCSM is really a living thing, and really effective development is probably the most crucial thing that we can do at LNAPL sites if we want to manage them effectively. So what we're showing here is figure 4.1 from LNAPL 3 document. This flow diagram really forms the backbone of the document. Just a couple things I want to point out here. The color coding is significant and refers you to different sections of the document. So if you're in a particular, if you have a particular area you're working in and you want to just quickly reference the pertinent parts of the document, you can see these colors here refer to the sections below. The other thing I want to mention is we present these as if they are separate LCSMs, these different parts of the LCSM, whether it's the initial CSM, the remedy selection LCSM, or the design and performance LCSM. But really, you could think of the LCSM as one body of information that is going to be continually evolving as the focus changes when you move through different stages of a project's lifetime. So the LCSM is always evolving, and really it never ends until project closure. As Tom mentioned, we're going to focus on the first two parts of this today, the initial CSM that is really focusing on identifying LNAPL concerns, so the why we would remediate, and then the remedial selection LCSM, which is more of the how we might remediate. And hopefully as we get through this, we can help with some of those concerns Tom's poll identified in terms of technical limitations or budget limitations. I know one thing that is really crucial or one of the biggest ways you can go wrong with budget is implementing remedies that are not appropriate and ineffective. So let's hope we can help apply some good science and assist in that regard. So this is just really a simplified version of the previous flow diagram. Just a couple different things to mention here. So we have our three different stages, initial CSM, remedy selection, design, and performance LCSM. So we're focusing on the first two parts. The third part will be covered in the next internet-based training if you're interested in that. I believe that's next week. So two things to note here. One, there are different parallel paths that are shown in the process. And really, this is just meant to be a conceptualization to guide your thinking. It's not meant to be overly prescriptive. These things are not necessarily well-defined. Just a way to organize your thoughts as you approach your site. So the data collection and interpretation and the decision-making pathways are really things that happen concurrently. And the more simple a site is, the more concurrently those will happen, because you may be working at a site that is relatively simple in terms of site characterization data and well-established in terms of concerns, and you may have a presumptive remedy. So you may have initial CSM and a remedy selection CSM that are happening really in tandem. Or you may have a more complex site where those two stages really need to have a little bit more separation between them just to make sure that you are understanding all the concerns and coming up with the most effective remedies. So as I said, we're going to focus on the initial LCSM, and it's really all about establishing the LNAPL concerns or the why of why we would remediate. So there are a number of different types of concerns we could have. Perhaps the most obvious are the risk and safety. So we would be talking about things like exposure to groundwater, vapor intrusion issues. We could have acute safety concerns with explosivity, those sorts of things. We could also have a concern with migration. So is the LNAPL moving into areas that aren't always or already contaminated? That might be a concern. Do we have mobile NAPL in wells? This is the most obvious sign that we have an LNAPL site is when we first see LNAPL in wells. And that triggers that could trigger many regulatory requirements in terms of recovering the LNAPL or making attempts to do so. And we could have other concerns. So the other that we're showing here, these are really going to be more like aesthetic concerns, issues with odors, staining, perhaps sheen issues, things that wouldn't really be captured in these other concern scenarios or categories. Typically, we do pretty well at the initial LCSM and establishing what the concerns are at a site. It's pretty well established. We have pretty well established processes in terms of figuring out if there's risk, if we have migration potential, these sorts of things. But we've also had a lot of developments more recently that are included in the new LNAPL document that highlight some areas where we could possibly improve how we approach these sites. Most notably, they are with respect to evaluating LNAPL movement and stability, or LNAPL biodegradation, which really captures both PVI issues, so petroleum vapor intrusion, natural source zone depletion, dissolved phase MNA, all these sorts of things. So there are better tools we have now. We are better able to quantify things surrounding mobility and stability, and we have gotten a much better understanding more recently of the role of LNAPL biodegradation at sites and the potential significance in terms of both characterizing the site and managing it long term. Sheens are an issue that can be quite tricky to deal with at LNAPL sites, and the LNAPL 3 document has an appendix dedicated to sheens, and we also have TPH risk, another new ITRC guidance that relates to characterization of our sites and really fleshing out what the concerns might be in a more science-based way. So a common question is really, how do you know when your LCSM is complete? And, you know, there are going to be certain questions that we're going to ask at this stage at all LNAPL sites. And really the question is really to what length do I go to answer those questions? Because really it can be said that your initial LCSM is complete when you have enough information to answer the pertinent questions and have a high degree of confidence that you know what your concerns are. So let's talk about some things that we know we're going to need and some things that we might need. So the minimum required information is really going to be an understanding of where the receptors are relative to the LNAPL impacts, where the LNAPL is, and whether there's a potential that it might be moving into areas that aren't already impacted. So those are really the three sort of technical considerations. And then the LNAPL occurrence in wells is obviously an important factor. It has lots of implications with respect to regulatory-driven remediation efforts. So that's obviously going to be a need at a minimum. Things like hydraulic conductivity and getting a more detailed view of distribution of LNAPL and or dissolved or vapor phase contamination within the overall extent are things that are really going to most likely apply more to the remedial selection stage when you're trying to figure out where or how you may apply different potential remedial techniques. So as I mentioned earlier, there are certain questions that we're going to consider at all LNAPL sites when we're developing the initial LCSM. The questions that we show here are pretty common and seen in a lot of more recent LNAPL guidance from entities like ITRC or ASTM, CRC Care in Australia, US EPA and others. The idea is to have a systematic, standardized thought process and approach that will allow us to sort of cover all the bases and make sure we're not missing anything. So it doesn't really matter if you're dealing with a simple site or a more complex site, you're going to consider these 10 questions at every site. The only variable will be to what extent do you develop the answers? Do you already have simple answers for most of these questions based on the simplicity of the site? Or do you need to pursue multiple lines of evidence using more sophisticated tools to really understand what's going on at a more complex site? Here we have a conceptualization just trying to show the scalability of the LCSM, and the LCSM is really scalable along with the complexity of the site, so those two are directly related. So a very simple site might be called a tier one, where you, you know, contamination is on site, it's old, it's stable, there's no receptors nearby. Maybe the kind of site where you can pretty much go with a presumptive remedy without having to develop too many sophisticated lines of evidence to really get an understanding of things. But as the complexity of the site increases from tier one through tier three, you're really just getting into sites that have more complex site settings, perhaps more complex LNAPL situations, different types of LNAPL commingled. You probably will have off-site impacts. You may be less certain of receptor exposures, those sorts of things. So the tier one through three terminology, there aren't strict definitions to this in the document. It's just intended to demonstrate this whole scalability concept, and that this will be a site-specific thing, the extent to which you develop your initial LCSM. So if we look at this a little closer, just giving some examples of what might be considered a tier one versus a tier three. So in the top pane here, we have tier one. We might be dealing with a retail site, diesel in relatively homogeneous sand. We may know that the dissolved plume is contained on site. The mobility of the LNAPL is limited, with a transmissivity of 1 feet squared per day, which is just slightly above the ITRC de minimis range. The LNAPL is not under any building, so there's not really any concerns with sensitive receptors being directly impacted. And we know the release is old, 10 plus years, so right away we're going to be thinking, okay, this stuff's probably stable, the recoverable fraction is probably low, I don't have any concerns with receptors, I know I have a relatively low transmissivity. So I may not need to go much further at this point to have a pretty good idea of what the concerns are or aren't. If we compare that with the tier three example shown at the bottom with the gasoline interbedded soil over bedrock, so here we're dealing with gasoline, so a much more volatile and potentially soluble type of LNAPL that can have much more significant vapor and dissolve phase issues associated with it than the diesel that we talked about above. And then we have a fractured bedrock setting, soil over fractured bedrock setting, which is a much more complicated scenario than a relatively homogeneous sand. So in this site below, we may not understand very well what the LNAPL distribution is, or at least it will be much more complex. We may not have, and therefore we may not have as good an understanding of whether receptors are or may be impacted. Here we have LNAPL off-site, so there we have a much more complicating factor. And our example here also shows a well that seems to be screened across two different stratigraphic zones. So, you know, this may be a situation where if we saw a groundwater criteria and exceedance in this well, we may have a hard time figuring out if that's due to the actual groundwater quality in the area or if it's due to some movement of contaminants due to the well construction from one stratigraphic unit to the other. So a much more complicated situation, obviously, in the bottom pane, and one that would require a lot more lines of evidence and more sophisticated tools, most likely, in order to understand the issues. Okay, we're time for a knowledge check. So we're going to do a poll here. I'd like you to choose the best answer from the options shown below. So the concept of continually updating the LCSM throughout the remedial process means A, the LCSM should become increasingly complex throughout the remedial process. B, even if performance monitoring indicates progress toward endpoints, better check between borings to ensure uniform treatment. C, reinvestigate with the latest tools as new characterization technologies evolve. Or D, the LCSM is updated to inform decisions throughout the project. Each decision point may require different data. And you see the answers coming in. So by far, the answer selected has been D. So that means that over 98% of you understand that the LCSM is updated to inform decisions throughout the project as needed. And it's not a situation where you necessarily just go back and reinvestigate a site because there's a new technology available to you. It's more that, you know, just try to be smart about building a body of evidence that informs the important decisions that need to be made. So just to summarize, really it all comes down to this question. Is there sufficient information for a given question to support identification of concerns? That's how you judge the completeness of your initial LCSM. Or, on the flip side, is additional site characterization required for evaluating the concerns LCSM? So just a few things to note here. So the initial characterization activities may overlap somewhat with remedial selection activities. That's at a relatively simple site, that may be the case, and you may be able to gain efficiencies by combining mobilizations in order to gather two different pieces or seemingly independent information at the same time. One note of caution, though, as sites become more complex, there's more risk of bias if you try to develop remedial strategy or consider remedial options before you have a really complete understanding of the concerns and the complexities of the site. And with that, I think I will hand off to John Smith.
Actually, Matt, this is Eric, and I'll be taking this section. Thanks, Matt and Tom, for leading us through this orientation of the LCSM. So now we're going to take a closer look at the overall LNAPL decision process and some key concepts and terms. Before we do that, I want to mention this portion of the presentation comes from Chapter 5 of our guidance document. And let's take a look at three learning objectives for this portion. First is we want to become familiar with the overall LNAPL decision process and key terms including LNAPL concerns, LNAPL remedial goals, and LNAPL remediation objectives. We'll go through all that. Second objective, learning objective for this portion is to understand the three classes of LNAPL remediation objectives: mass recovery, phase change, and mass control, and apply the ITRC framework for LNAPL remedial decision technology selection using those concepts and those classes. And then the third learning objective for this portion is to understand how metrics are applied, including threshold metrics, which help us verify or eliminate LNAPL concerns, and performance metrics, which are useful for assessing remedy performance and effectiveness and determining when remediation endpoints have been met. So looking at our roadmap, we're here right now. This is our simplified flowchart. Tom and Matt showed this earlier. We've collected some data. We've built our initial LCSM. So now we take that LCSM and we need to kind of boil that down to some concerns, some defined concerns that we're going to address in our remedy selection and evaluation process. So basically, it's what needs to be done. And then after we figure out where we're headed, we'll get there through selecting technologies and implementing them and so on. And that's farther down in today's module and also in Module 3, which I think is next week. So as Matt introduced already, the LCSM, the first pass through the LCSM is really useful for identifying specific LNAPL concerns. And those concerns, we've kind of binned them or broken them into four categories. And we're going to go ahead and skip to the next slide to unpack those categories a little bit more deeply. So if we start with the world of LNAPL concerns, the first bin we can put those concerns into is risk and safety. And that might include PVI, or petroleum vapor intrusion. It might include ingestion of groundwater from petroleum-affected constituents. And it could also include acute safety hazards like fire and explosion risks. The second category of LNAPL concerns could include migration. And what we really mean by that is where maybe there's not a current risk or threat to safety, but if that LNAPL body were to continue to spread and migrate, it might result in future risks. So that's kind of the migration concern in a nutshell. The third category of concern would be just the mere presence of LNAPL in wells, mobile LNAPL occurrence in wells. And as Matt mentioned, many regulatory programs apply the maximum extent practical requirement from the federal regs to LNAPL in wells, and so that often triggers some kind of regulatory obligation. So we have it in here as kind of its own category. And then the fourth category is really a catch-all for everything else. That might include sheens or geotechnical concerns about weakening soil strength in the presence of petroleum and various aesthetic concerns such as stains and odor. And I should also pause and mention here that in order to identify these concerns, it's really important to engage your stakeholders because they may have concerns that one stakeholder may have concerns that another stakeholder doesn't share. So our document, our guidance document, includes some very good information on engaging stakeholders, especially in Chapter 2. So check that out. So this next slide shows the whole decision process in kind of a stepwise format going down the page from identifying concerns to verifying them to establishing goals and objectives, selecting a remedy and implementing it and measuring its progress till you're done. Let's take a look at real briefly kind of a preview of how that gets played out when we look at specific types of concerns and develop remedies to address those concerns. So in this first column example, we might start with a risk and safety concern. And let's say we have concerns about PVI or exposure to vapors, maybe about ingestion of petroleum-affected groundwater by potable water users, or maybe some fire and explosion hazards. First thing we're going to do is look at threshold metrics, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. That's the way of kind of vetting whether or not those you already have enough data to address those concerns. And then assuming that those concerns are validated or verified, risk and safety concerns generally relate to LNAPL composition. And we're going to talk more about that in a minute. So if it's not obvious right now, it hopefully will be in a minute. In order to address that LNAPL composition goal, we're going to do some remedial objectives that try and abate or change that LNAPL condition. We're going to look at remedies that actually do that and plan them and implement them in a way that measures progress and gets to a defined endpoint. So we're going to step through and unpack this stepwise process in much more detail here in the next few slides, but I just wanted to kind of give you a preview here. And then similarly, if we had migration concerns, they're going to follow their own similar process, but maybe select different goals and different technologies. And also for MEP or mobile LNAPL concerns, occurrence concerns in wells, they're similar to migration concerns in some sense, and they're going to have their own set of processes and technologies. So let's, with that preview in mind, let's kind of look through each step in a little bit more detail. So if we start with an LNAPL concern, let's say risk and safety, we may have a concern about the risk of ingesting benzene in groundwater at a potable use well. Now, we may have at this stage enough information to know whether or not that concern has been realized or not. For example, we may have monitoring data that show that the plume is stable and it hasn't reached any potable use wells and is unlikely to do so if you've got enough monitoring data to demonstrate that. So there may be an off-ramp here to say that that concern is not really been verified or that there's data to show that concern is has already been addressed and doesn't require a further remedy. Although in other cases, you won't have sufficient information. You need to go forward and look at either a remedy or collecting more data. Same thing for a migration concern. We may have data on the LNF body stability to tell us right now whether or not migration is occurring or is likely to occur. So for those things that aren't off-ramped at this stage, do we need to take those concerns and identify some remedial goals? So let's pause here and take a knowledge check quiz to see if you've been paying attention. Which statement is true? An LNF of concern is A does not need to be identified before remedial action occurs. B may sometimes be addressed by testing against a threshold metric. C is nothing to worry about, or D can only be addressed through remedial action. And the voting is pretty strongly in favor of option B, which is the most true of these statements, that sometimes you may have enough data to address an LNAP concern against some kind of threshold metric. So that is the right answer. Thanks very much for voting. So we'll go ahead and move on. So of these four types of LNAP concerns, each one needs to be translated into a measurable LNAP condition or a goal that, where we want to change that LNAP condition in order to address that concern. And an example here is if we're concerned about risk, it's generally the risk-driving components of the LNAP that are driving risk, and often that's something like benzene, either for groundwater ingestion or vapor intrusion. And it's the benzene component within the LNAP that really needs to be addressed most directly. And that usually involves changing the composition of the LNAP to reduce the benzene, for example. For migration concerns, migration, as we learned in Module 1, is all about having sufficient LNAP saturation to allow that LNAP to flow and migrate. So to address migration concerns, we're typically going to be looking at controlling or reducing saturation of the LNAP in the subsurface. For occurrence concerns, they're also really a saturation-related issue because in order to get LNAP to migrate and accumulate in monitoring wells, we need to have sufficient saturation. So our LNAP goal is going to be to change that saturation to reduce that occurrence. And then finally, the other category is kind of everything else and might include changing the aesthetics, you know, staining and odors, for example, or some other combination of the things above. For brevity, the next few slides are just going to look at those first two concerns, risk and migration, because they're a little bit easier to talk about. So I've already mentioned these two terms, remedial goal and remediation objective, and they sound very similar, but we need to be really clear on what each means. The remedial goal is kind of like the big picture, what victory looks like, is essentially. It's the desired change you want to make in the world, in this case in the LNAP condition, in terms of either changing its composition or changing its saturation or something else. So this is the aspiration that you want to achieve in the end. It's kind of like what does winning the war look like? And you establish this before you go about looking for a remedy, because this kind of tells you what done looks like. And then the second category, these remediation objectives, are more the tactical things you do to win the war. They're the actions and the outcomes that you need to do with a particular technology to achieve that remedial goal. And it's at this stage where those remediation objectives may be developed in parallel with remedy selection, because some remedies may require different types of tactics and definitions of objectives. And I do want to mention here that if you are familiar with our old ITRC LNAP guide, the first one we came out with, we actually had these definitions reversed, and we realized that was kind of inconsistent with current, you know, business use. So we've defined them differently here. So just pay attention to that, and hopefully we haven't confused you with that change in definition. So goals, this big picture, what's the desired outcome or desired change look like? We can break those into two types of goals, a composition-based goal or a saturation-based goal. At this stage, you have enough information to start the process of selecting a remedial strategy, but you really can't pick a remedy until you know what it needs to achieve. So this is where we kind of really need to define what it is we're trying to do. Are we trying to change composition, for example, by reducing vapor concentrations or reducing groundwater concentrations, or are we trying to change saturation such that it reduces or contains or contains any migrating LNAPL? So do this first before you choose your technology, because this is going to help you select what technology you need. So, you know, getting down to the tactical stuff, to the remediation objectives, this describes how that goal gets accomplished by the selected technologies. The remediation objectives state the actions and the desired outcomes that need to occur using the chosen technology. So this is kind of like how you apply a particular technology in order to achieve the goal. And when you've done this properly, and you've agreed on what the endpoints look like and how you get there, then the whole package, this whole strategy becomes SMART. As Tom mentioned, that means specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-based. So once we have in mind a particular set of goals and objectives, we need to categorize remedial technologies by what type of thing they do to the LNAPL. What's their primary remedial mechanism? Because different technologies act differently on LNAPL. And the three categories of three mechanisms that we've defined here include mass recovery, phase change, and mass control. Now, mass recovery is like it sounds. It's basically removing LNAPL mass in order to abate migration or to remove LNAPL to get you to a maximum extent practicable regulatory definition, et cetera. For phase change, we want to do things like abate any unacceptable vapors by sufficiently depleting the volatiles out of the LNAPL. It also might involve reducing dissolved phase concentrations by depleting the soluble parts of the LNAPL. And then finally, for mass control, we may be looking at containing LNAPL at a defined boundary or preventing migration beyond a particular point of compliance, et cetera. So notice that all of these objective statements typically have active words like stop, abate, control, change, et cetera. And that's important to help define these objectives. By the way, Matt mentioned natural source zone depletion, and I'll just mention here that that's a type of remedy that really can work across all three categories of remedial mechanisms. And we'll talk more about that in a while. So how do we think about technologies, and what do they do? In our guidance document, this is also referred to as the primary mechanism. But in addition to the primary mechanism, some remedies can have collateral effects or, you know, multiple mechanisms. So you can think of mass control, phase change, and mass recovery as kind of like three points along a triangular spectrum or a ternary diagram. And that big black dot there in the middle could just be the place where it sort of expresses how that particular technology acts. So in this case, it might be a dual phase extraction technology. Well, it both recovers mass and extracts and depletes LNAPL through phase change and biodegradation. So it kind of acts as both a phase change and a mass recovery mechanism. Also a little mass reduction as well, or mass control. So the key point here is that some technologies have more than one key mechanism and may serve more than one objective. And then finally, in this portion of the training, let's talk about where we're headed with this selection of these selection of goals and objectives and implementing a remedy. We want to have the end in mind. And to get there, we need to think about monitoring performance along the way to assure the effective implementation of the remedy. And then we need to define what done means, what's the end point. And it's important to define those endpoints as things that can be achieved with that technology. So rather than trying something and seeing what happens, this is really more a process of defining what's expected to happen and measuring it along the way and figuring out when you're really done. And all of these together are part of that SMART paradigm that we talked about earlier, and they are all technology specific. So with that, I think it's time to pass back to Tadbir for our first question and answer break.
Thanks, Eric. At this time, we will open the question and answer portion of our training. So for those of you who are on the phone line that are interested in asking a question, I will give you the opportunity to do that in just a moment. Remember, it's #6 to unmute your line. For anyone else, at this time, you can type your question into the Q&A pod in the bottom right corner of your screen. We will try to get through as many questions as we can. Just a reminder for those of you that are interested in receiving a certificate of completion, that they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box that you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. So let's go to our phone lines. If you would like to ask a question out loud, this is your opportunity to do so. Once again, it's #6 to unmute. If you have any questions, you can also feel free to type it into the Q&A pod in the bottom right of your screen. Okay, would SVE be considered both phase change and mass recovery?
I'm sorry, Tadbir, can you repeat the question?
Sure. Would SVE be considered both phase change and mass recovery?
Yes. Yeah, that's an example, much like dual phase, where because you're both physically removing volatile constituents and introducing oxygen, which is biodegrading and changing composition, you're both reducing mass and changing composition.
Thanks, Eric. Could you describe best methods to measure transmissivity?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about transmissivity coming up, but not really getting into specific methods. And I don't know that I would say that there is, specifically a best method. It's it sort of comes down to, what your objectives are, what you need from the test. There's pros and cons to a lot of, transmissivity testing methodologies that there are out there. I'd recommend maybe looking at the ASTM 2856 document. It gives a good overview of, I think, what, four or five different transmissivity testing methods. And it also provides some comparison. So it sort of helps to highlight, you know, what the niches are for the different methods. And you can sort of use that to align with what you're trying to achieve, what you're trying to get out of your transmissivity tests. For example, you might want something that focuses on a longer period of recovery, or covers a larger area. I'd recommend look. There's a really, really great comparison table that would probably make those kinds of decisions.
Yeah, and I would just add that it depends. It will depend somewhat on site conditions and LNAPL properties as well. So some test methods depend on equilibrium conditions, which may be quite challenging at certain sites. And there are also some methods that will depend on you being able to accurately measure small changes in well LNAPL thickness, which can be also quite challenging, particularly if you have a very viscous LNAPL type. So, as John mentioned, probably the best thing to do is to look at the ASTM E2856 method and or the ITRC transmissivity appendix in the LNAPL 3 document.
Great, thank you. How do I best explain to regulators a path forward when transmissivity is well below 0.8, but we have 10 feet of LNAPL in a well? It's hard to convince them.
Well, since I'm the regulator on the seminar today, I guess I can try to answer that for Sean. I think, at least from Colorado's viewpoint, we recognize that simply because there is a lot of product in a well doesn't necessarily mean it's economically recoverable. We recognize that many other states have regulatory standards where, for example, all LNAPL needs to be removed from a well to some measure, perhaps down to an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch. However, a lot of states have adopted risk-based strategies to deal with LNAPL releases also, like Colorado. So I think the best thing to do, Sean, as we get into this, as you'll notice from also last week with part one, we talked about how LNAPL can accumulate in a well to very extreme thicknesses due to geological and hydrologic controls on the well itself. And I think trying to document those situations to convince the regulator of the reality of what you're dealing with is the best path forward.
Okay, seeing no more questions, we will move on. Thank you so much for the questions and for the trainers for providing their answers. We are now going to move on to the next portion of our training today, and I will move on to slide 39. And I will pass it over to Matt.
Thanks, Tabir. So we've talked a bunch about the initial LCSM focusing on establishing concerns, and we're going to move on now to talking a little bit more about the remedy LCSM. So why are we focusing on the remedy LCSM? Probably the biggest reason is that it's the biggest area of potential improvement in terms of LNAPL site management. Our current practices are pretty good when it comes to characterizing sites and establishing concerns. But some areas that we still struggle with are really connecting remedial strategy with the concerns in terms of implementing techniques or technologies that will realistically achieve whatever our remedial goal might be. And two, to sort of get out of the habit of assuming that in-well thickness, or especially large in-well thicknesses, are going to be associated a priori with LNAPL mobility concerns and large recoverable fractions. We know working on many sites over many years that that's just not going to be the case at many sites. So those are probably the two areas that we can really improve things and focus on. So let's consider an example that will help us understand one area where we can improve remedy selection. Say we have LNAPL in a well. That's going to trigger a requirement to recover the LNAPL in many jurisdictions. Say that well is within an area that is relatively stable, so there's no obvious migration potential, no concerns with mobility, moving in areas that aren't already contaminated. Should we just go ahead and give it a go with an aggressive LNAPL removal technique like a periodic backtruck events? So periodic backtruck events, many of us will be familiar with that. It's not an uncommon approach. It's an approach that a lot of people feel good about because we're implementing what is conceptually an aggressive recovery technique. We're inducing drawdown, hydraulic drawdown. We're using vacuum enhancement. So we're really sort of giving it a go. So let's sort of consider if that's going to be beneficial. So here we're gonna look at this in terms of transmissivity. So what we're gonna try to do is we're gonna try to apply a better science-based metric compared to just looking at magnitudes of in-well thickness and see if that can help us get to a better solution here. So what we'll do is we'll look at the site. We know some of the things we know about the well with LNAPL. We know the thickness is 2 feet. We know the transmissivity is about 2 feet squared per day. And we know roughly that our volume in our well is 1.4 gallons. If we know that our monthly vacuum truck can achieve a 2 foot drawdown and we do it for about an hour, we can come up with an estimate that will induce a flow into the well of the 1.4 gallons that was initially in the well plus an additional 1.7 from the formation. So we're looking at about 3.1 gallons per month. So our monthly events will put us at about 36.2 gallons per year. And we can use tools like APIs, American Petroleum Institute's LNAPL Distribution and Recovery Model, or LDRM, to come up with some estimates of what kind of saturation reduction that represents and how long it'll take us to get to a practical endpoint to the recovery in terms of transmissivity, or the 0.8 feet squared per day ITRC recommendation. So our monthly backtruck events are going to get us to about a 0.4% saturation reduction across a 25-foot radius each year, and it's going to take us about 25 years to get to that 0.8 feet squared per day. So you can already see this is maybe the backtruck events are not looking so hot anymore. So if we sort of shift our attention to what we might be able to achieve with a seemingly less aggressive technique in terms of continuous skimming, as I just said, continuous, so apply continuously, and we again use API LDRM to see how long it would take us to get to that same endpoint. So we can do a simulation with LDRM analytical modeling. We can calibrate to our known LNAPL transmissivity value, and we can do this relatively quickly to figure out that active skimming can reach our goal in about 0.8 years. So we're going to reach the same endpoint in 0.8 years with continuous active skimming as we would in 25 years with monthly backtruck events. So this is just an example of how we can do a couple different things. One, we can use a more science-based metric in terms of transmissivity to come up with a better solution, a solution that shows us that the appropriate application of a seemingly less aggressive technique can actually be more successful and more effective in a much shorter time frame than a seemingly more aggressive technique. And it also shows us the benefit of focusing below the ground in terms of looking at how do we change conditions and how are we changing conditions over time instead of just focusing on what volume we're getting up out of the ground. So that's a really different, really important change in perspective that can really alter the value we place on different potential techniques. So the key is that we want to use science-based metrics and good information to inform our remedy selection, not just the concern. The concern doesn't tell us much about how to take care of it. So if we know we have LNAPL and OL, that definitely doesn't tell us if it makes sense to try to get it out or what the best way might be to do it and how to apply that, whatever the best technique is. We need to go further if we're going to figure these things out. And the way we start to do that is we identify approaches to answer the following questions. We need to know where the remediation needs to target. We need to know which remedial mechanisms may be effective. And we need improved quantification of these mechanisms prior to implementing the technology. These things would seem self-evident, but as I said previously, these are definitely areas of improvement in terms of really matching remedial techniques and mechanisms to the concern. So similar to the initial LCSM development questions, we can look at a list of questions for the remedy selection LCSM as well. And we really need to answer all of these questions if we were going to get at an effective remedy. And each of these questions will inform the one that comes after it. So where is the source mass? What is the nature of the source? And what is achievable for a given technology? All key questions, all questions that you can drill down into further. And again, similar to the initial LCSM, the extent to which we consider each of these questions for a given site will scale with the complexity of the site. So let's talk about the first question, where is the source mass? It seems like this would be an easy thing, but it actually can be quite tricky. So we'll talk about some different ways we can look at where the source mass might actually be. And the goals or the key considerations are really to evaluate soil permeability distribution and depth of impacts relative to the water table. Those are going to be the two key things. Table 4.2 in ITRC LNAPL 3 contains a list, or a relatively comprehensive list of possible tools you can use to help you in this regard. So we'll talk about a few of those tools as we go through this next example, and we'll talk about ways we can identify where the LNAPL is, and we'll also talk about ways that can help us identify the hydrogeologic condition, because that's an important consideration that affects both the LCSM as a whole and what techniques we might consider that may be effective for a given scenario. So the cross-section you're looking at is showing a number of different things. One is showing the stratigraphy of the site. So we have a fill layer underlain by a fine grain unit, underlain by a coarse grain unit. So we're looking at fill, clay, sand. You can think of it that way. Each of these red profiles is showing a laser-induced fluorescence profile. So where you see peaks, the laser is detecting LNAPL presence through fluorescence. And each of these colored bars you see is relating to observations in wells. So blue bars are just showing the water column within a well. Green is showing where LNAPL is. So this would be a well that is pretty much full of LNAPL. These few, you can see that there's LNAPL with water. So you can actually see the LNAPL water interface. So let's just drill down more on one of these locations, MW2. So a couple key things. So if we look at the light blue profile, this is showing the laser-induced fluorescence, or LIF profile. That's really showing the bulk of the LNAPL is down in the sand layer. But if we look at our well observation, the LNAPL thickness actually extends well up into the clay. So right away, we should be thinking that this is probably a confined situation. So we have a more permeable zone overlain by a less permeable zone, and we're seeing this difference in where the impacted zone is in the soil with what the well observation is showing us. So this is going to be a pretty typical example of a confined condition. A couple different things this is going to tell us. One, if we just focused on the well observation to show us where the LNAPL is, that would really lead us astray, because as we can see from the lift profile, the LNAPL is really contained down here in the sand and not really up in the clay as the well thickness suggests. The other thing to consider is that if we are thinking about vadozone techniques to remediate the LNAPL or somehow address concerns of LNAPL concerns, at the site. If we're looking at things like SVE or vacuum enhanced techniques that focus on the vagus zone, those are really going to be ineffective. So if you looked at the well thickness, you might think that there would be a certain level of effectiveness by trying to address vagus zone impacts. But as we can see here, most of the impacts are actually down in the sand below the water table. Another way to look at this site condition is through a diagnostic gauge plot. So we're plotting fluid interface elevations on the y-axis against LNAPL thickness on the x-axis. And doing this just really allows us to normalize the data to an extent that exaggerates or makes it easier to see the relationship between the two different data sets. As you can see here, the NAPL water interface, the blue dots, stays relatively stable as the fluid interface changes, whereas the LNAPL thickness increases, it seemed to increase as LNAPL or as the potentiometric surface increases. So that is a very typical example of a confined situation. So you see that direct relationship between potentiometric surface elevation changes and changes in in-well LNAPL thickness. So here's another clue that we have confined conditions just through the slope of this line. One thing to note is that diagnostic gauge plots really only work well if you're using equilibrium data. So if you have part of your data set, like what we're showing here in these red circles, that is associated with a pumping condition or immediately following an LNAPL removal event, those are going to be non-equilibrium data. And if we were to include those in our analysis, you can see that we would have a much harder time coming up with this line. So important to note that we should definitely be focusing on equilibrium data here. Now, if we overlay the soil types, you can see here's the yellowish color is associated with the sand, and the darker brown is with the clay. You can see, if you think back to the LIF profile, we're showing about a 2.4-foot saturated LNAPL saturated thickness right below the clay, and this seems to be shown here as well. So we can see that the top of LNAPL rises well up into the clay in the well, but remember that our mobile NAPL interval that LNAPL is coming from is actually right here in the sand. So that's where we would want to target if we were if we had concerns associated with that NAPL that required remediation. So let's consider another condition. So this cross section is showing again a stratigraphic profile. We have fill, sand, and then overlying sand and clay. So in this case, we've flipped the permeability zone. So in this case, we have a higher permeability zone on top of a lower permeability zone compared with the previous example. These red profiles, again, are LIF profiles, in this case, UVOS data. And so we're seeing here that the LNAPL impacts are generally above the water table. So if we saw that and we knew that the LNAPL was not from a new release, then one thing we could immediately conclude is that it's likely mostly residual. Otherwise, it would have extended into the water table. But we do have to keep in mind that this water table condition might just be different than historical. And I'm just going to focus on this well here, PZ8, for a moment. So we have LNAPL up in the sandy zone. This well screen extends across that sand-clay interface and is really sort of like a sump into this clay. So if we see this significant LNAPL thickness here in this well that's associated with this type of construction going through a high permeability, low permeability interface, and then we also have the LIF data showing that the actual NAPL impacts are up higher in the profile above the water table, then we should be starting to think that this is maybe a perch condition and this this well is just acting as a sump that is collecting LNAPL over time. So let's look at that through the diagnostic gauge plot. So you can see that on this diagnostic gauge plot, the slope of this line is different than what we saw for the last one. So now we have an inverse relationship between in-well thickness changes and water table elevation changes. So when the water table is dropping, the LNAPL thickness is going up and vice versa. So that could be a perch condition. That could also be an unconfined condition. So one way to sort of tell the difference is looking at the ratio between how the LNAPL thickness changes in response to a certain water table elevation change. So in this, if this was an unconfined situation, say, consider for sake of example, a 1 foot drop in water table. In an unconfined situation, we would expect to see an in-well thickness increase that would be 1 foot or less. But in this case, we're seeing LNAPL thickness changes that are on the order of 4 feet. So you can see with a that's also characteristic of a perch scenario where you have that exaggerated ratio between in-well thickness changes and water table elevation changes. We can also look at over here at some soil core results. This is showing a core photography result. We have a white light photo on the left and a UV light photo on the right showing LNAPL fluorescing. So even though we know we from our well gauging we have pretty significant in-well thickness, we can see that it's coming from a relatively discrete LNAPL zone in the soil. So there's another hint that this is more likely to be a perch setting, not typical unconfined setting. Our last diagnostic gauge plot that we'll look at in this section is with respect to a bedrock setting. We can see on the right, we have a plot of conductivity against depth. And you can see that as we go down, we have a bit of a conductivity change, a discrete conductivity change here at this depth, which also seems to coincide with our NAPL water interface. And then we also see that direct relationship where NAPL water, where the potentiometric surface increases, the in-well thickness also increases. So we see that we have a relationship that's characteristic of a confined setting here. We see we have a very discrete change in conductivity here. So we can be pretty confident that the LNAPL we're seeing in this well is associated with this fracture. So these things are really helping us target where we would apply different remedial techniques and also helping us to screen out certain remedial techniques that are unlikely to be effective. So just to sum it all up, we are fortunate now that we have lots of sophisticated tools or more or less sophisticated tools that we can use to figure out what types of soil we're dealing with, what the permeability distribution is, because if we're considering any remedial technique that involves the injection or extraction of fluids, we definitely want to know where the preferential pathways are, what the distribution of permeabilities are, because that's going to tell us where those fluids are going to go. We have different tools that we can use to figure out the hydrogeologic condition, whether we have a confined, unconfined, or perch setting. Those are key pieces of information that help us figure out what techniques may or may not be effective. A couple rules of thumb here that we know through experience is that vacuum will have limited effect on confined LNAPL, and that water drawdown has limited effect on perch NAPL. If you remember that example, we had quite a bit of LNAPL flowing into that stumped well. But the LNAPL in the soil was actually not connected hydraulically to the water table. So drawing down that water table wouldn't produce much of a benefit in terms of trying to extract more LNAPL. Just a few things to keep in mind. And of course, the key, or at least one of the key things, is the LNAPL source distribution. We have lots of different things we can look at. We talked about LIF, we talked about core photography, we gave some examples of how LNAPL transmissivity can be used. There are other things that you can use as well. So understanding LNAPL distribution is really key, and overlaying that LNAPL distribution or considering it along with your stratigraphy information and your permeability distribution information is really going to be key to understanding if you'll be able to access that LNAPL with some type of injection or extraction gradient technique. Geophysical data, we talked a bit about how you can use conductivity and diagnostic gauge plots to gain some insight into a bedrock situation. I would point you to the Bedrock appendix of the ITRC LNAPL guide, and ITRC also has a standalone fractured rock guide. So really the key is to identify the vertical intervals of fractures and how do those relate to where you're seeing your LNAPL. And with that, I will hand it off.
Thanks, Matt. And I want to take just a quick minute. We had a question during the break about how to explain, the well with a really low LMAPL transmissivity, but we were seeing really large thickness accumulations, like 10 feet of LMAPL accumulating. And the question was about how to explain that to a regulator, how to sort of conceptualize that. And a lot of the things that Matt was just walking us through, you know, the discussion on how we can use LIF, the core photography, diagnostic gauge plots, those are all great tools for helping to better understand, you know, what he was talking about, where the source is, and they can kind of help to communicate that, you know, even though we may have LMAPL accumulations in a well of 10 feet, a lot of times those map to very small intervals in the formation. So really what we need to do in those kind of scenarios is, and I think Tom talked about this as well, the influence of the geology in those in-well accumulations. But that's sort of the point we need to make in that sort of scenario usually. So moving on, up to this point, we've been talking a lot about the tools and the concepts that we use to help us determine where we should be targeting our remediation. Questions that we're going to move into are a bit focused, maybe a little bit more on how. So to start, we're going to be talking about the properties of the source material and how those can help us to determine what remedial mechanisms are the most likely to be effective for us. So for example, whether or not the LMAPL constituents we want to target are volatile or biodegradable, and what fraction of that LMAPL is mobile versus residual. So one of the important things that we want to be talking about today is when we're evaluating recoverability is LMAPL transmissivity. So yeah, we got the poll up. Thanks, Tabir. Here we wanted to gauge the level of experience that the class has with LMAPL transmissivity. We've talked about LMAPL transmissivity in the previous training session in part one. A few slides back, Matt walked us through a really great example of how we can apply LMAPL transmissivity to evaluate the potential performance of different remedial approaches. So he was looking at the vac truck versus the skimming approach. And we're going to talk about it more throughout the training today. We're also going to discuss other tools and metrics that we can use to assess relative performance for other remedies. What we can learn from LMAPL composition and soil gas composition, what those might tell us about biodegradability and volatility of the source material. So going back to our poll, it looks like we have a bit of a mix in experience and familiarity. You know, this is not unlike some of the previous classes that we've had, and you know, the material that we're going to cover today, it's intended to address a pretty wide variety of experience levels. So we can close the poll and move on. So here we're trying to bring out a linkage between different remedial technologies that utilize different mechanisms on the left, and we're bringing them to different characterization data that we can use to evaluate whether or not that mechanism is likely to be effective on the right. So for example, we've got hydraulic recovery technologies, and we might use activity to determine whether or not that sort of remedy is likely to be effective. Or we might evaluate technologies that rely on a vapor phase mass transfer mechanism, like a slow vapor extraction, multi-phase extraction, things that we were talking about earlier in the training today. The LMAPL composition and the vapor pressure of the constituents that we're trying to target. So again, we want to point out that the characterization data that we're going to be using to identify different remedial mechanisms, it's often very different from the data we use to establish the concern. So in a lot of cases, we might not even be looking at these particular aspects of a site unless we'd already established that remediation was going to be necessary. So again, just kind of bringing out that difference between the concerns and the remedy selection LCSM. So we've got another poll question here. If we can open that up, Tab here. We're going to walk through an example exercise together. And here we've got a site with a dissolve phase concern. So we've got, let's say, benzene that's sourced from an LMAPL body. And we can see in the figure to the right here that we've got LMAPL transmissivity data. It's telling us that the LMAPL is more recoverable in the dark green areas. We also have some additional monitoring data that tells us the LMAPL footprint is stable and not migrating. So we can wait for a moment, let people decide whether it makes sense to proceed with an LMAPL recovery approach here. But there is a dissolve plume, so we need to think back to things we learned in part one of the training and a bit of what Eric talked about earlier today on the difference between composition and saturation concerns when we're deciding on whether or not to select a hydraulic recovery remedy, so specifically to address a dissolve phase concern. So I'd say probably the best answer here, and this is sort of a trick question a little bit, but the best answer is probably C, and that's because we don't have a full picture yet. So we're going to move to the next slide. And on this slide, we're showing the LMAPL distribution. And one of the big things to note here is that we have extending about 30 feet above and about 60 feet below the water table. So we've got this mobile LMAPL interval, and that in this small 2-foot zone around the water table, 1 to 2 feet thick. So let's say that if we were to implement some hydraulic recovery, we'd probably reduce LMAPL saturation within that 1 to 2 foot interval, and maybe reduce the saturation by about 10%. But even after we've removed that mobile LMAPL, we still have residual LMAPL that's in contact with groundwater right within that zone near the water table. And the hydraulic recovery isn't going to do anything to affect the residual LMAPL in contact with groundwater beneath. We're thinking back to that discussion that we had earlier today on the difference between the saturation and the composition goals. Think about the discussion on Raoult's Law from part one of the training. We talked about reducing LMAPL saturation isn't likely to have a significant effect on groundwater quality concerns. And, you know, this is an example where we've got a pretty large site. There's been some historical water table depression. Probably helped to smear the LMAPL over a pretty large vertical interval. But we want to highlight that these same principles really apply for smaller sites too. So the green text at the bottom, we're just describing similar conditions, just scaled back. The relative difference between the vertical extent of the mobile interval of LMAPL and the smear zone, in a lot of cases, it's probably not going to be quite as dramatic as our example here. But we still need to understand that vertical distribution and how the interplay of mobile and residual LMAPL are going to interact to help us define which remedy is actually going to address a dissolve phase concern. Okay, so here, this is a really quickly talk. We're going to talk about the LMAPL transmissivity and what it tells us about mobile and residual LMAPL fraction. So we've got some background information. This goes into the 1 to 0.8 square foot per day range for LMAPL transmissivity in the 2009 ITRC LMAPL guidance document. So we're going to try and put that range. We can start by noting that LMAPL at residual saturation, it doesn't flow in our implied gradient, so it has a zero transmissivity. And then we can start to think of a threshold LMAPL transmissivity value that starts to represent an LMAPL saturation that's slightly above residual. So there's a little bit of mobile LMAPL. You know, there's a very small fraction of recoverable. And that's really what that 0.1 to 0.8 range represents for us. So, and most transmissivities, the values in that range provide a really strong line of evidence that the majority of the LMAPL is present as a discontinuous residual phase. So we're going to keep that in mind, and we'll circle back to it later in the training today. But for now, we're going to change it up and spend some time on other remedial mechanisms. So on this slide, we've got some examples of data that we can use to infer composition and volatility. So like soil headspace screening data might be useful for us, or maybe we historical site use that can tell us what type or what types of LMAPL have likely been released at a site. So we're going to talk about laboratory analyses that we can use to identify LMAPL types and the extent of weathering or degradation. And we're going to be focusing a lot on what we get from gas chromatography with a flame ionization detector, so that's abbreviated here as a GCFID. And the bar chart along the bottom of this slide gives sort of a high-level summary of what we get from that GCFID data to help us determine LMAPL type. And we'll a little bit more over the next few slides here. Here we're zooming in on the gasoline range of a chromatogram and getting a little bit more into the details of the chromatogram. We've got lighter hydrocarbons on the left, and as we move to the right, the hydrocarbon compounds increase in boiling point and generally in the size of the hydrocarbons or the molecular weight. So along the y-axis, the height of the peaks gives us an estimate of the relative mole fraction for individual hydrocarbon constituents in the LMAPL. So here we've overlaid some of the individual constituent IDs, and we can start to get a sense for the amount of detail you can extract from a chromatogram like this if you know what you're doing. And for today, we're really primarily interested in identifying those ranges that are going to help us to select the best remedy. So if we're looking at the chromatogram and it's got most of its peaks sort of concentrated to the left, then we can be fairly confident that a vapor phase mass transfer approach is probably going to be fairly effective, assuming that we have appropriate geologic conditions for that sort of remedy. And that kind of goes back to what Matt covered in the first part of the remedy selection LCSM. We need to understand where the source is and, you know, LMAPL distribution and permeability and how they're going to affect each remedy that we're considering. So on this slide, we're looking at an example of a fresh diesel chromatogram. You can see there's really little response in that blue gasoline range. And in this case, the lack of peaks in that gasoline range tells us that those remedies that rely on a vapor phase mass transfer mechanism probably aren't going to be that effective. But the really prominent peaks that we see here, you can see them labeled the MC10, which is decane, through MC18, octadecane, I think, are the normal alkanes. And alkanes are really biodegradable, so not volatile. Probably aren't going to be able to use SVE very effectively, but you can biodegrade them. And on that biodegradation note, we'll just kind of segue into a short discussion on the importance of NSCD for this discussion today. So, you know, there's been a lot of developments for NSCD recently, and we're starting to use NSCD data more frequently. We talked about earlier today the role of NSCD in stabilizing LMAPL bodies. There was some really good material on NSCD in part one of the training, and we're going to have a more comprehensive three next week. Today, we're really focused on evaluating biodegradation as a remedial mechanism and how NSCD can provide a useful baseline for us when we want to assess biodegradation potential. Sort of similar to how we might use LMAPL transmissivity when we're thinking about or how we're looking at vapor pressure if we want to look at the vapor phase removal mechanism. So We noted on the previous slide, or a couple slides back, that alkanes were really biodegradable. And it's really important because historically, there was a perception that conditions in LNAPL zones, LNAPL source zones, weren't really conducive. So a lot of people thought that the only the more soluble hydrocarbons were going to be susceptible to biodegradation. This is something that was touched on in part one, again, where we saw that biodegradation isn't really limited to those lighter, more soluble compounds, and pointed out that dissolution isn't a necessary precursor for biodegradation. So we sort of established that we don't really have that solubility limitation. We're also pointing out that biodegradation is dependent on molecular structure. So saturated hydrocarbons, those alkanes we were talking about, tend to be more biodegradable. And the more highly branched hydrocarbons tend to be more difficult for microbes to utilize. So when we've got more complicated molecular structure with bonds that are more difficult to break, there's lower energy yield, and the microbes typically aren't as efficient at degrading those compounds. So here we're going to dive into the composition and sort of compare relative efficacy of different mechanisms as a function of composition. Compounds with to the right along the x-axis again. This is similar to the charts on previous slides that we familiarized ourselves with, and we've got relative vapor pressure normalized to naphthalene in this purple or plum color. Gasoline range are more susceptible to the phase mass transfer mechanism. So everything to the left of naphthalene there. And next, we're adding on relative biodegradation rate constants. So these are also normalized to naphthalene, and we're showing those in green. You can see that there's a lot less variability in the biodegradation rate constants over the full spectrum that we're looking at here. And finally, we're adding relative solubility on the chart in light blue. So again, these are normalized to naphthalene, the lighter monoaromatics that have a solubility greater than naphthalene, so they plot greater than one here. And the larger aromatics and aliphatics that dominate the composition all plot less than one. Parameters we're comparing, they're all in different units, so we can't really directly compare them, but this gives us some really good insight into the variability of these different mechanisms for the different hydrocarbon constituent target. So while the vapor pressure is decreasing by about five orders of magnitude within the gasoline range alone, and your compounds we've got here, what we want to really highlight is that the biodegradability is a lot more uniform across the whole range of hydrocarbons that we're talking about. And again, I think this also highlights a little bit that the biodegradability correlates to solubility. So a lot of these points that we're looking at, there's lower solubilities, high biodegradability, and a lot of those would sort of line up with the alkanes. Again. So now we're summarizing different types of data that we can use to evaluate these mechanisms with the goal of comparing different kinds of remedial technologies. So regardless of the mechanism that we're evaluating, we want to understand what Matt covered on where is the source. So no matter what kind of remedy we're thinking about, we're always going to need to know something about the distribution of the source material, the permeability distribution is. If we're thinking about recovery remedies, we're probably going to want to know something about transmissivity. We might want to collect some data on NSCD or respiration test data. If we're evaluating bioremediation, of course, the composition data can help to inform the bioremediation and the vapor phase. So some additional examples here, again, just characterization data that we can use to evaluate different technologies. So the technologies that rely on reagent or carbon injection thermal remediation technologies, and some of the information that we need to have in hand and to evaluate those. So the main takeaways from our discussion on the nature of the source, we often see a default to hydraulic recovery when we're trying to address LMAPL, but we really want to point out that we've got tools available to evaluate different remedial mechanisms, and we'd like to be able to compare expected performance between different mechanisms, so we can make decisions or what combination of those mechanisms is likely to be the most effective for us. Okay, so now we're moving on to the third and final remedy LCSM question. So this is what can we achieve with a given technology? And this question really builds on the previous two questions pretty heavily, right? So to determine what we can achieve with a technology, we need to understand what the subsurface conditions in LMAPL distribution are. We want to know something about the LMAPL characteristics, above ground conditions, like what's the current land use, safety considerations, and some of the characteristics of the technology itself and how that plays into how we've implemented it. We're going to take a closer look at LMAPL transmissivity as a metric for hydraulic recovery. So this will, again, is going to give us some of that background information on that 0.1 to 0.8 threshold range. And give some context as to what the range means with respect to recovery performance and what it means in terms of understanding that fraction of LMAPL in mobile or residual phases. So we're going to review data from four different sites with different subsurface conditions. And we're showing some of the characteristics of the four sites here. We've got hydraulic conductivity, for example, that varies between the different sites. So different site conditions, different LMAPL, different remediation of system setups, and that's one of the nice things about transmissivity is that you can apply it when those, you know, you've got different geology, you've got a different type of remediation system, a different LMAPL type. LMAPL transmissivity is still giving you a way to sort of integrate those and evaluate them all together. So we'll be looking at the fraction of the total LMAPL mass that was recovered as a function of transmissivity at these four sites. And at all four sites, LMAPL transmissivity was tracked based on recovery system performance data for several recovery wells. And the fraction of the mobile and residual LMAPL was evaluated using decline curve analysis techniques, laboratory petrophysics, and soil TPH data. So to begin, I want to look at the numbers along the bottom here. This 14, 14, 6, 2, these values indicate the initial pre-recovery LMAPL transmissivity values for these wells or sets of wells at these different sites. So we just laid out, we've got the site, three different categories with different wells or groups of wells, and the initial transmissivity values here. And at those sites, the evaluation, sites one and two, the evaluation is really focused a lot on the recoverable interval here. So basically the LMAPL that falls within this dashed line here, whereas at sites three and four, there was a lot less recoverable LMAPL before remediation began, and the characterization efforts were focused on the entire smear zone. So that include not just within the dashed lines here, but also the halo of residual in the pink around it. So next we're going to go over some of the information summarized in this bar chart here, and we'll start with well 7 at case study site 1. So again, you can see at the bottom of the chart that prior to recovery, there was an LMAPL transmissivity of 14 square feet per day at well 7. Now the darker blue chart represents the fraction of the LMAPL that was recovered, while the LMAPL transmissivity was above that transmissivity threshold range. And we've noted the duration of the recovery that it took to reduce the LMAPL transmissivity from that initial value, so in this case 14 square feet per day, within the 0.1 to range. So 2 years brought it from 14 to roughly 0.8. And here we've got the light blue, which represents a fraction of the LMAPL that was recovered beyond that recoverability threshold range. And again, you can see the amount of time that the system was operated under that condition. So an additional 0.6 years and very little additional LMAPL array represents the remaining mobile LMAPL. So this is based on the decline curve analysis projecting out to estimate how much more LMAPL the system could have recovered if operated for longer. And then finally, the granitic pattern at the top of the bar chart. This is telling us the residual LMAPL, so how much LMAPL was still in the format recovered, regardless of how much effort we were to put into the to pumping it out. So let's see. Here we're looking at all of the four sites included in the study, and we can note a few things about the recovery performance. So for sites 1 and 2, we noted before that those had more recoverable LMAPL, but even between those two, we can see that the recovery was a lot more efficient in the initial years of operation for site 1 when above the threshold range. And a lot of that comes down to differences in the recovery well layout. So for example, at site 1, the wells were located on a grid pattern throughout the LMAPL body, whereas at site 2, wells that were essentially installed along a transect, and we see sort of a weaker decline signal as the from further distances with less drawdown propagated out into the formation. So site 3, very low transmissivity to begin with, and as we noted before, they were LMAPL before any recovery began. So again, primary takeaway here is that that transmissivity within that range, or below about 0.8 square feet per day, generally a really good indicator that most of the LMAPL mass is at residual. So hydraulic recovery approaches aren't going to be very effective for us under those kinds of conditions. All right, so we just spent a lot of time talking about hydraulic recovery, and that's primarily because LMAPL remediation has just with a focus on hydraulic recovery. So here we're stepping out of the box a little bit, and we're comparing mass removal potential based on transmissivity data that was collected within the API LMAPL transmissivity database. So that's a bar chart on the left here, and results from respiration test data from the EPA AFSI study completed in the 1990s. And you can see that the removal rates that we're showing here, they're pretty similar, but what we need to point out is that the average removal rates shown here for the biovending sites are calculated on a per foot of vadosome basis. So per foot of smear zone above the water table, basically. So if we've got a smear zone that extends a few feet above the water table, we would predict biovending rates that would be proportionally higher than those shown in this chart. Additionally, worth noting that while the hydraulic recovery is typically going to decline exponentially over time, so as we reduce that amount of mobile LMAPL in the formation, we tend to see the depletion signal decline exponentially, whereas for biodegradation, we often see the rates sustained over longer periods of time, and it's acting on both the mobile and residual fractions. So just something to keep in mind when we're evaluating remedial technologies. In addition to doing a bail-down test, we may consider doing something that assesses the potential for bioventing, like a respiration test. Okay, so sort of shifting focus to the volatilization mechanism. On the right side of this slide, we've got a series of chromatograms showing changes in LMAPL composition as a gasoline sample was volatilized. So each of the chromatograms, again, is normalized to a naphthalene peak height, naphthalene representing sort of the low end of volatility for gasoline here, again. We can see that as more of the gasoline is evaporated, the relative concentration of those compounds decrease relative to naphthalene. And that helps to tell us that things like SVE, MPE, those are likely to be pretty effective in reducing concentrations of benzene and maybe the overall GRO concentrations. Sort of interesting here, we're sort of highlighting so we can see that relative to other compounds in the gasoline, the toluene doesn't appear to volatilize as readily. And see evidence of toluene remaining at SVE sites, for example. And the likely answer to that is that toluene is really biodegradable. So these kinds of remedies, SVE or MPE that we were talking about, in addition to vapor phase mass transfer, they're also delivering oxygen to the subsurface to enhance biodegradation. And that's a concept that Eric talked about a little bit previously with the ternary diagram. But relevant here as well, and we'll talk more about it. But this is again sort of highlighting the significance of biodegradation and helping to remind us that when we're setting our performance metrics for an SVE system, we might also consider measuring oxygen and carbon dioxide and the influent vapor stream in addition to the VOCs. It might help us to quantify what fraction of the mass losses that we're getting are attributable to biodegradation instead of just the pure volatilization mechanism. Okay, so this is an example case study. We're sort of highlighting some of the stuff we talked about on the previous slide. We had a multi-phase extraction system that was operated to address a gasoline release here. And the cross-section is sort of showing our generalized stratigraphy here. We've got sand and gravel deposits shown in the bright green, finer-grained overbank deposits in the darker greenish-brown color. And the chart at the bottom of this slide is showing the mass removal performance for the MPE system through three different or three different mechanisms for the same remedy, rather. So in black, we've got a performance curve. In gray, we're showing the vapor phase partitioning. And in the blue-green color, we've got biodegradation. So we can kind of see that the LMAPL recovery was pretty dominant during the first year of operation, or at least was the dominant mode. At a vapor phase removal that performed pretty well for most of the six-year time frame we're showing. But ultimately, the most dominant mechanism was the biodegradation. And this is even for a gasoline release. So after 6 years of operation at the site, we still got benzene in groundwater that needs to be addressed. And the poll at the on this slide, looking for everyone's thoughts, given the results that we just talked through on that chart, what remedial mechanisms might make the most sense going forward to address that that benzene in groundwater? And yep, really strong response on B, the bioremediation, and that's exactly right. I think given the data that we've got, that's the sort of approach that we want to move towards. So maybe something where we consider bio mass below the water table. Okay. Yeah, so we can remove the poll tab here. Thanks. And on this slide, we're really emphasizing the need to combine what we know about the technical limitations of different technologies with whatever site limitations we might have to deal with. So for example, we probably aren't thinking about applying a thermal remedy beneath an active refinery. We're highlighting here that we need to consider, you know, the potential effects of the waste streams that we're going to generate from a particular remedy. You know, technologies that rely on a groundwater recovery or water table depression, those are probably going to be more appealing at an operating industrial facility where we've got capacity to treat groundwater rather than, you know, at a retail gas station site. And we're also highlighting, you know, if we're operating a vapor extraction system that requires a lot of, you know, a propane to operate an oxidizer, this is a condition where we might consider modifying and optimizing that system to focus on, you know, what are likely the most dominant mechanisms. Because at this point in the remedy, that might actually be biodegradation. All right. So when we're talking about what's technically achieved, we can apply a tiered approach, and this is similar to what Matt had described earlier today for the concerns LCSM. If you're looking at a more complex site or a site with greater risk, and we probably want to be more quantitative in our, we can use our LCSM to, you know, relative performance of different technologies and how they might help us to meet our goals. We touched on this earlier, but it's worth noting again here, when we're selecting a remedy, we really want to be able to compare relative performance for different technologies. So given that different technologies are going to utilize different mechanisms, it can be a challenge to sort of compare them. So it's helpful to convert performance estimates into similar units. And we've got a few examples of those here. For example, if the remedy is focused on bulk removal of LMAPL, maybe it makes the most sense to compare the pace of remediation for those different remedies in terms of the conventional NSCD unit. So look at something that's evaluating mass or volume per unit area per unit time. All right, so to summarize the technically achievable portion of the remedy, select LCSM, we want to emphasize that we've got different tools available to evaluate those different mechanisms that we were talking about. We don't need to just approach is the answer if we've got LMAPL accumulating in wells. We can compare expected performance from other mechanisms and determine which ones are likely to be the most effective to reach our goals. And we've got some examples of that here. We're going to end the remedy selection LCSM here with a knowledge check. So we've got a scenario outlined here where we've got sheen on a creek with LMAPL in a nearby well. We're showing that the LMAPL transmissivity is pretty low, less than 0.05 square feet per day. And we're wondering if we should consider LMAPL recovery. And is that LMAPL recovery remedy likely to be the final remedy? And what else might we consider doing to improve remedy selection? We've got a good mix. I think I see pretty close to even on whether or not hydraulic recovery should be considered. I think, you know, that's reasonable. There's probably a little bit of back and forth between the low transmissivity value, ease of implementing hydraulic recovery as a sort of an interim measure. Maybe it's like nobody or very few people are selecting recovery as the final remedy, and that's that I would definitely agree with. For the final question, I think, you know, the only answer that I would is totally right is A, and nobody has selected A. I think all the remaining options are probably things to consider. You know, improving our understanding of LMAPL distribution. That's always going to be a good idea if we're trying to identify a remedy, and quantifying biodegradation rates is always going to be helpful. So with that, I'm going to pass the presentation back over to Eric Nichols with Substrata, and he is going to give us some more insight on choosing remedial technologies and identifying performance metrics and endpoints.
Thanks, John. John's done a nice job taking us through the remedy selection phase of the LCSM. So let's go ahead and I guess I should advance the slide first. There we go. Let's go ahead and return to that decision process for a few moments. We've seen this slide before, and we know that in order to select a remedy, we need to have some remedial goals and some remediation objectives, and that remedy also needs some performance metrics to assure it's being implemented effectively, and also an endpoint to know when you're done. So what about performance metrics? Just a few points here. They're technology specific, so once we've started to select a remedy, we need to mate our performance metrics to the kind of remedy that we want to implement. Metrics are useful for verifying that the remedy is being implemented, but they're also good for showing you when it's not being implemented and things are going off the rails and you need some kind of mid-course correction. It also helps you track progress towards an endpoint. And a couple examples here. One would be, let's say we're doing bioventing, and which is really what we're trying to do there is almost like enhanced NSCD. We're trying to stimulate depletion through bringing in oxygen. So one metric that we might look at to help maintain the performance of that remedy would be to watch and measure oxygen in the targeted zone of LNAPL-affected soil so that we're keeping it at some minimum to allow that biodegradation to occur. And in addition to that kind of performance metric, you probably look at other lines of evidence as well. Maybe track the change in composition of your LNAPL or the gas phase or the aqueous phase in contact with that LNAPL. So in addition to performance metrics, we want to think about what the endpoint looks like. When's done? What does done look like? That's also technology specific. Maybe a good example here would be, let's say you've got a concern about benzene in groundwater. That is going to mean you're going to be looking at changing the LNAPL composition and stating some goal related to that. In order to do that, we know that benzene is both volatile and soluble and it's a component of LNAPL. So we want a phase change mechanism that's going to drive that benzene out of the LNAPL. And in this case, maybe an SCE remedy would be appropriate. So when is an SCE remedy done? Well, it'd be done when either the dissolved concentrations are reduced to some risk-based level or regulatory limit, or you've reached the practicable limits of that technology. So, and that's a key point because you may need to transition to another remedy after the one you're in, and that transition should be expected and planned based on the expected performance of the technology and not really be a disappointment nor a surprise. So let's do a quick knowledge check on metrics and endpoints. Which of the following statements is true? Are performance metrics and endpoints optional? Are they the same for every technology, or are they technology-specific and site-specific? It's a pretty easy one. And the voting is overwhelming on the item C, choice C, which is true. They're always technology-specific and almost always site-specific as well. So let's go ahead and move on. So putting all of this together, we can look at how this plays out, how this decision process plays out for specific types of concerns. So in the example here, perhaps we have a dissolved phase concern. LNAPL is giving birth to a dissolved phase plume that may affect a supply well. We look at some groundwater monitoring data to verify that that concern is real. We then establish a remedial goal to reduce those dissolved phase concentrations to some standard. The objective is then to reduce those dissolved phase impacts we're going to select a remedy that can do that. In this case, it's maybe air sparging and SVE. We want to have some performance metrics to make sure that that remedy is working. In this case, a stable dissolved plume might be one of several metrics. And then when are we done? We're done when we've stabilized those dissolved concentrations or standards have been met at some point of compliance, which might be a sentinel well or in many locations. Key point here is those metrics and endpoints are probably not just one thing, but they're probably you're probably looking at multiple converging lines of evidence, like we typically always do. A couple other examples here, one showing migration and how that plays out, and the third one here, LNAPL occurrence in a well or the MEP requirement and how that might get played out. And that's all in Figure 5-2 in our technical guidance document. Bear with me just a moment. It looks like my connection had a little hiccup. Hopefully yours didn't. So I'll just go ahead and talk on the next slide. So what you're going to see in I need to advance it. Sorry about that if you're seeing the same glitch that I'm seeing. On slide 86, this is a view into what we're going to see in the third training module. And this is where we take this LNAPL site conceptual model, identify the concerns, identify enough, develop that LCSM to the point where we can select and implement a remedy. Well, how do you actually do that? That's really the subject of the next module, is how do you go from the pile of information that we've talked about today to really figuring out which of many remedies works is going to work best for you. A little preview as to the steps that you'll see in the next module is shown on this slide. There's a screening step that you'll learn about where you kind of screen your technologies against the goals that you've identified. You're going to kind of essentially filter out those ones that best fit and are compatible with your geologic factors, your site-specific characteristics. You're going to learn how to do a comparative analysis and look at getting additional data that you might need to better make that selection, and then how you select and implement that technology. So that's what you're going to learn in Module 3. And to summarize where we've covered today, you've learned that this decision process is a systematic one that allows us to identify concerns, establish goals using verified concerns through threshold metrics. It helps us identify the right technologies to abate those verified concerns. And the LCSM is sort of the guiding light here. We refer to it and refine it and develop it at many steps. First, to identify concerns. Second, to develop a remedy. And then, again, iterating to implement that remedy successfully. And all of this is smart. And leads, hopefully, to project success. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Tom to give us some closing comments.
Great. Thanks, Eric. And we're rushing to the finish line here to try to stay on schedule. We're near the end of our Part 2 training, and one thing we'd like you to be aware of is that next week we'll be talking about discussing remedial technology groups, and how to best look at a lot of the technologies we're trying to use to address LNAPL concerns. We're also going to be introducing specific remedial technologies, the different tools in our toolbox. We'll be trying to provide a framework for technology selection, and we're also going to be introducing ways to screen technologies for various uses, and also introduce performance metrics so that you can optimize your efforts and decide when to stop using a technology or even switch to a different one. And finally, at the end of next session, we're going to be doing a case study to walk through this entire process that we've talked about in this seminar so that you have a better understanding of how to implement it for yourself. So as part of waiting for the next session, we'd like you to do a little bit of homework, and we'd like you to think about one of your sites and what data you have available to go through a short remedy selection conceptual site model exercise to be able to select the technology mechanisms or confirm that the current technology you're using is the best one that you should be trying. And we're going to be providing some additional insight on remedial technologies next week, or actually in 2 weeks, I believe, which will help a little further with that evaluation. And with that, I think, Tadbir, you're going to come back and wrap this up.
Yes, thank you, Tom. And at this time, we would like to have another Q&A section. Remember, you can type in your question at the Q&A pod in the bottom right corner of your screen. But before we get to the questions, I'm going to pull up a couple poll questions for you to fill out. Also, the Clue In training page will remain active in case you'd like to access it at a later time. We'd like to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked to this last slide. You can also access the feedback form by clicking feedback in the related link section and then clicking browse to. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion. And at this time, we will move on to a few questions. Remember, it is #6 to unmute. We have one that just came into the Adobe Connect. What is the more accurate field method to identify mobile LNAPL versus residual LNAPL? If any of the trainers would like to take that question on?
Yeah, I can try to field that. I think we talked a lot today about how we can use LNAPL transmissivity as sort of a relative indicator of how much of the LNAPL at your site is mobile versus residual. There's also tests that give you maybe more definitive answers. One way would be to actually collect soil cores and have them analyzed in a laboratory to determine how much of the LNAPL moves out of the soil under an applied gradient. So maybe they stick the core in a centrifuge and spin it to promote LNAPL flow, and then measure how much LNAPL is remaining. It gives you an idea of how much of the LNAPL is mobile versus residual. There's also various modeling approaches you can do that you could, if you're looking to further some of the information from the transmissivity results that you might already have. So again, low transmissivity indicates that you don't have much mobile LNAPL, if you try to do some background modeling on what the vertical equilibrium distribution of fluid pressures is in the formation, you can start to better understand maybe how much LNAPL might actually be present as a residual phase. So
yeah, I would.
Thank you for that answer.
Oh, I would just add to what John said. Those are all good points. One additional thing you can consider, not necessarily the most accurate way, but a tool that's available to you, is TPH soil concentrations are the same as LNAPL saturations. You can, if you have TPH data, you can convert to LNAPL saturation and use lookup value for residual, soil type specific residual values to try to figure out, or at least get a rough idea of what your recoverable fraction might be.
Great, thank you so much. And we have time for maybe one more question. How long should a transmissivity test run? 1 day, 1 week, 2 weeks?
Yeah. I think that's Sort of similar to the previous question about how to select the best method for estimating transmissivity. This one has maybe a not exact answer. So, you know, it depends a lot on what you're trying to understand. I think if we're talking about just how long to monitor recharge for a bail down test, it's still, there's a lot to unpack in coming up with that answer. And maybe it starts with how important is it for you to get a really accurate answer, because you may be able to infer something about you know, LNAPL transmissivity. You may be able to put, for example, a less than value on it without collecting a full data set. In a lot of cases, you may have background water table fluctuations that might sort of limit your ability to calculate a transmissivity going forward. So it might make sense to end a test at that point. But on bail down tests, most other test methods have variable runtimes. You know, tracer testing, for example, would be one that you implement over a period of months, and you go in kind of expecting to do that. Of course, if you're using recovery, that's something that gets tracked periodically, but is run for, you know, the life of the remedy usually. So yeah, I apologize. I feel like I didn't give you a concise answer, but I don't think that there really is an easy answer to that question. It comes down to a lot of different factors.
Okay, well, thank you for your questions today, and thank you to our trainers for providing answers. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered, or you're welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document, and special thanks to our participants today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. Remember, we do archive our classes, so if you are unable to join our live classes, you're welcome to access our archives. Remember, the third part of this LMAPL training series will take place on January 30th. Thank you for joining us today, and we hope to see you on the 30th.
All right.